Continuing in Mitzvah Shin Mem Gimel 343, not to lend, not to borrow with interest when the borrower and the lender are two Jews. V'chein, we're continuing in the discussion of what constitutes ribis derabanan. We point out that ribis deraisa, the biblical interest, only forbids something that's prearranged between a borrower and a lender of an additional fee that is given for the fact that the person held on to the money. That is called ribis kitzutza, or set ribis, and that's what's prohibited midaraisa. But there are other things that resemble ribis that are what's called avak ribis, dust of ribis, and those are prohibited midarabanan. V'chein, ein poskin al haperos ad sheyetze hasha'ar. Pre-arranged advanced payment. This is very common in today's society as well. Rabbi Reisman and his Sefer on Ribis has a lengthy discussion of, you know, when you subscribe to books that you're going to get every new edition, and they haven't been published yet, and these things are potentially a violation of Ribis, because when you pay for something in advance, you're essentially giving the publisher or whatever, whoever's offering this this item for sale, a loan. The item's not around yet. You're giving them a loan. And then, in exchange for the loan, they give you the book, or whatever the item is, at a cheaper price. So that's avak ribis derabanan. It's avak ribis because you essentially gave a loan and you get a favor in return.
What about if the...
Okay, so here in the Sefer HaChinuch, we're not talking about newspapers, but we're talking about fruit. When you want to order fruits, vegetables in advance, so you're not allowed to set the price of the fruit. You're not allowed to order the fruit, set the price, until Achiyetze Hashar, meaning until there's a normal price for this type of fruit, in which case you're allowed to order it. Aval Yatza Hashar Poskin, yeah, Afal Pi She'ein Lezeh, Yesh Lezeh, even though this merchant does not have this thing in stock right now, and as such, it could be interpreted as giving the seller a loan until he provides you with the item and not a purchase right away. Nevertheless, since the price has been established and the fruit must be available somewhere if the price has been established, so then it's theoretically possible for you to get this fruit somehow, so therefore it would be considered a purchase and not a loan. So this also only applies the prohibition to pre-order the item before the price is established when the seller has absolutely no stock of this item. So you order cherries from him, and the seller has absolutely no cherries in stock. But if the seller has even a few cherries in stock, even if you ordered 100 cherries and he only has 3 cherries in stock, since he has some in stock, so then you would be allowed to order even if the price had not generally been established yet. So you're allowed to order a large amount of the fruit, even though he only has a small amount. And then there's a whole textual issue over here that the girsa of the Sefer HaChinuch that was in front of the commentator said shehalacha kishmuel da'amar, that the halacha follows Shmuel in the Gemara, who says the following statement. But the problem is that Shmuel, the statement is never found in the Gemara in the name of Shmuel. Okay, so the one of the commentaries, the Minchas Yitzchak, I believe, changes the girsa to kemo b'halva'a da'amrinan. Okay, I don't think it's exactly clear what's going on over here, but it says it's comparable to a case of a loan. Damrin achi ba gemara. V'zeh she'anu omrim she'tzarech she'yelo me'oso hamin. Yesh me'farshim she'amrus. The question is, what constitutes the seller having this item in stock? What's considered the same item? Davka me'oso hamin mamish tzarech she'yelo. It has to be this exact item, literally. Shimu posik al chitin chadoshos. If you want fresh grain, grünkern, right? That's fresh green spelt grains that have, you know, not old ones. There, most grains that we have are old and dried out. You want the fresh, you know, moist grains. Lo yivsok elav im hayu lo chitim yishano. So this doesn't work if you have only old dried grain in stock. That's not considered the grain that this customer wants. So therefore, you're not allowed to make a pre-order until the price is normative in that area. Ela kein oso amin mamish abosuk alav tzarech sheyelo. He has to have the exact idea. Yishmin shamru shein chilog ben chadash liyashan. The son to say, come on, no, we don't go that far. That has to be exactly. I mean, more or less. It means if you have the whole sheyelo meoso amin motor. If you have any type of wheat, even though the customer wants a slightly different type of wheat or a different age of wheat, then that would be allowed. That if you have an unfinished item, so let's say you just have stalks of wheat, and the fellow wants wheat kernels. So you have to thresh it and winnow it. Okay? So you have to do some stuff in order to get him the grain kernels. So that's still okay. That even though the item isn't actually available right now, you still have to work on it to get it, so that you'd be allowed to pre-order. Aval hayam mechusar shlosha melachos eino posek. That three is the magic number somehow. That three is the magic number. If you have to do three types of labor in order to get this item to the status that the customer wants, then that would not be considered as if you had that item in stock. So let's say the customer, instead of ordering grain kernels, ordered flour. Mm-hmm. You have to thresh and winnow and grind. So that's no good. Okay? Va gemar perek ezu neshech va ber barucha bechilog melachos elu bechitim. So the Gemara explains at length what the difference would be regarding wheat kernels v'chein bechli yotzer v'dvarim achirim. Let's say you order a tool and how much of a distance between the raw materials and the tool there has to be, but this would apply to any object that requires some work on the part of the storekeeper. V'chein me'inyin hamitzvah masha amru asru. Lahalvos al hakarka mos, lahasnos im alove, im lo tachzer li hamos, mikan vad yomploni te hakarka sheli. So you have this case where you lend money and you say to the borrower that if you don't return my money by a certain time, your land becomes mine. Taking your land. This is a major principle, important principle in halacha of what's called an asmachta. What's an asmachta? It means like an assumption. So at the time when the borrower and the lender were conducting this transaction, if you don't return my money within a certain amount of time, so I'm taking your field. So the borrower at that time thought, okay, sure, okay, you'll take my field. Yeah, I borrowed $5. I'm not going to give it back to you on time. I'm taking my field. So that's called, it's an asmachta, meaning that you're sure that this is not going to happen. So somehow you didn't get the $5 together in time, you didn't pay back. And it's as if you were forced into not paying it back. So then if you eat the produce of this field, it's like ribis, it's like interest, because it wasn't, the guy didn't really intend to give you a kinyan, a full kinyan, as if he's buying your field. Okay? So this is a general principle in halacha, that what's called asmachta lo kanya, that if you have something that's like outlandish, then it's an invalid transaction. So the Sefer Chen is going to explain a little more. Bahar beidrachim namru bagimara basmachta beinyan ribis uvinyanim acherim. So this not only relates to interest, but it has other ramifications as well. V'derech klal limdani Rebbe Yishmerokel. My Rebbe taught me, who was very likely the Rashba. That if you when you have an agreement between two people, and the if the agreement doesn't come to fruition, that one person suffers a penalty. Not like a normal condition. It's not like, you know, and what?
You put up collateral when you borrow money. I mean,
yeah, but this is like excessive. Mm-hmm. It's like two people are discussing and you're like, if I can do 10 push-ups, you'll give me $1 million. Yeah, if you can do 10 push-ups, you know, you think this person is like really out of shape. There's no way he's going to do 10 push-ups. Oh, God. And $1 million, you're really going to ask me for $1 million? Or, you know, come on, you know, $1 million? So the guy, lo and behold, he does 10 push-ups. So that's an invalid transaction. He would not actually have to pay him $1 million. It's also, there's also a related thing called Meshata HaYisibach, that certain times in Beis Din, that the argument of I was just kidding works. So Beis Din has to... you know, figure out exactly when to apply that, yeah?
But if somebody takes out a mortgage where, you know, you're putting up your house as collateral, you know, for the loan, then you don't expect you're going to default. But on the other hand, I mean, the you know, here, it's not that the value of the land is, of the your house is out of proportion to the loan. It's
a, right, exactly.
You know, as a matter of fact, if you default, then the bank, you know, sells the house and then gives you refunds and the difference to you.
But that's not derech knas. No. That's saying I want to borrow money, which is equivalent to the value of my home.
Yeah,
that's exactly. That's not derech knas. That's one of the things I mentioned last time, that one of the objections to the RCA halachic prenup is that it's an asmachta, that you say when you get married, so the husband says to the wife in this document, if you ever decide not to live with me because you don't like me anymore and you move out of my house, I have to pay you $150 a day. So the guys at the time they're getting married is thinking, oh, come on, you know, my beautiful bride, we're ever going to get divorced. Is she ever going to want to leave me?
Well, that's ksuba also. I mean, what, you think you're going to go after the
ksuba,
nobody thinks they're going to have to get the ksuba is going to
be... No, the ksuba is a payment after the marriage ends.
Oh. Okay, but nobody's
going to
think the marriage is
going to
end when you,
Well, no, the marriage, what do you mean? It applies either when you get divorced or you die.
Okay, yeah. I guess it's possible to die, right?
Okay. So the ksuba, unless she predeceases you, the ksuba is going to get paid. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are other ways to work out the finances, but that's not an asmat. Here's the thing, there's no way that ever is going to happen. Mm-hmm. $150 a day is a ridiculously large amount of money. And, you know, this simply isn't going to happen. And that's why it's considered to be an asmachta. That's why Rabbi Bleich says that in order for the prenup to be effective, its provisions need to take effect immediately at the beginning of marriage. So that's why his prenup says that, again, I explained last time, that the wife, starting from the beginning of the marriage, has the option of either, you know, going to the fridge and taking out food or getting a certain amount of money per day. It's built into the right away, the option starts. So the defense of the RCA prenup is that when you go in front of what's called the Beis Din Choshuv, a really important Beis Din. So if you go in front of a Beis Din Choshuv and you make the declaration, you know, if you would go in front of Beis Din of, you know, Schechter, Willig, and Neuberger, whatever, three big centrist Orthodox Rabbanim. So if you go in front of them and say, declare with full solemnity, you know, my out of shape friend, if I'm going to pay him $1 million if he manages to do 10 push-ups, then that might not be an asmachta. That might be, since you did it in a more formalized way, then it would be okay. So that's the justification of the RCA, that signing the prenup, which is deposited in the Beis Din of America, is considered to be accepting what might otherwise be an asmachta and a Beis Din choshuv, and then it would not be a problem. Okay. Kilomar im lo yakein yonesh b'mamon kach v'chach. If something happens or doesn't happen, then he'll be penalized with a certain amount of money. Ze yikari asmachta. V'al ze yomru zichronam l'vracha. De asmachta lo kanya. Doesn't work. Any if is not a valid condition. What do you mean, if is not a valid condition? But that doesn't apply to every if. Obviously, if it's just going to someone else and saying, if you do this, then I'm going to do this. So that everybody makes conditions with the word if. Obviously, there's nothing to do with asmachta. Otherwise, nothing would no transactions could work at all. Everybody uses the word if. If everything with the word if was an asmachta, how could business be transacted at all? Obviously, if it's something's reasonable and you use the lashon of if, of im, then it's not a problem. And obviously, we find in halacha many times that we have halachically valid conditions using the word if. You know, you could think gittin v'kiddushin, ago this is really not done anymore. There is such a thing in halacha as having a tanai with a marriage or a divorce. So technically, it's possible to for a husband to give his wife a get and say, "Hareze giteich, this is your get if you do 10 jumping jacks." You know, you can make any tanai that he wants. Again, it's not done. I've seen a lot of gittin. One of them is al tanai. We obviously don't allow it anymore. But technically, halachically speaking, it is possible to impose a condition on a marriage or divorce. And it could apply the other way also, that you could say that a woman could accept kiddushin. It has to be in by way of a penalty. If you, I don't pay you back within a certain amount of time, then you can have my entire field. Or, you know, what all this this major collateral that I gave you, so you can have it. But other conditions are good. If you go take a trip, so I'll give you some money if you do this trip on my behalf. So if you go to the store for me, I'll give you $200. So understand this well, so you shouldn't get confused by when the Gemara says that condition is good and when it says it's not good. That it's basically, the idea is if it's unreasonable, if it's by way of penalty, then it's no good. But if it's just a manner that people normally institute conditions, then that is good. There, another type of rabbinically prohibited interest is ribis mukdemes v'ribis milcheres. That ribis that's done before a loan is discussed at all. Remember, for in order to be ribis deraisa, you have to be making the loan, and you have to say, "Here, I'm lending money, and you're going to pay me back more money than I'm lending you." That's ribis deraisa. But if ribis is given before a loan is even discussed, and ribis that is given after the loan is repaid are only ribis derabanan. Ketzad. This is what Melchior asked last time, that you want a loan from someone, so you send some presents in order to butter him up, that he should give you a loan. That's usur because of ribis derabanan, of avak ribis. Ze ribis mukdemes, that's pre-ribis. So if you paid back a loan, then you send presents afterwards, that's low as like a thank you. Zehu ribis milcheres. That's called post ribis, and that would also be aser midrabanan. V'chein amru k'tzas v'nam efarshim. Some of the commentators say as well, sheha malve mos lachaveru al mokom sheperosa mitsuyin tadir. Kegon chotzer u'merchatz v'chanus. That if you lend out money to someone else, and you mortgage to him a place where that always produces a profit, kigon chotzer u'merchatz v'chanus, a store, a bathhouse, or a courtyard. So these places, there's no chance of them losing money, I guess, you know. I don't know, it seems anything's possible, like a bathhouse could dry up and there'll be no rain and there'll be no water, okay. Different things happen, but basically you're guaranteed a profit. Everybody needs to bathe. They didn't have indoor, in-home bathing facilities, so they had to use the merchatz. So it was guaranteed that you were going to turn a profit, that you had the right to use the merchatz while the other person was holding on to your money. So below nikoi hareza ribis kitzutza. So according to some authorities, if you get to enjoy the profits of a guaranteed profitable enterprise while your money is in the hands of someone else, then that's ribis kitzutza. That's ribis deraisa, as prearranged here. I'm gonna borrow your money and I'm gonna give you my bathhouse and you're gonna be guaranteed to make lots of money from this bathhouse. So that's considered to be ribis deraisa. Uvenikoi hareza avak ribis. But if you subtract some money from the loan based on the amount of money that he makes from the or based on his usage of these facilities, then that would only be avak ribis. Ava malve, that'd be the rabbanon. Ava malve mos below nikoi amakom she'ein peros of mitzuyin tadir. But if you lend out money to someone, and then in the meantime he gets to use a place that you own that is not guaranteed to be profitable, he goes in sodev acherem, like a field or a vineyard. So he takes, it's a risk, because a field or a vineyard, it could be a bad vintage. Maybe you won't, they won't produce that much produce. Sometimes you have to invest more money in the vineyards than you get out of it. Nevertheless, it's ribis dirabanan, because he's not guaranteed a profit, but lemaise he might be making more money than he lent out to the lender. Uvenikoi hareza mutter, but if you subtract money then it from the loan, then it would be allowed. Umehem shamru, some say shafilu besadev acherem uvenikoi asura chachamim zirchana lebracha. Some say even that is asur midirabanan, that you have a vineyard, say, that's not guaranteed to produce more money than you lent out. That they, even if you subtract money from the original loan, the Chacham nevertheless prohibited it. Velo matzu mashkona muteres ala mashkanta desura. The only type of mortgage that is permitted in halacha is a special kind of mortgage which is called the sura. Sura was a place in Babylonia. So this is the type of mortgage that they used in sura. Shehayu kosvin, that they were right in the document of a mortgage as follows. B'mishlam shnaya ilein tepuk arada b'loch saf. That at the end of these years, that in other words, the term of the loan, the land that was mortgaged to you because of the loan will return without being paid any money. So in other words, your usage of the property is the sole payment of the loan. So in other words, that's considered to be like a rental and not like a loan at all. Mm-hmm. And my Rebbeim are even more lenient than the first opinion which I brought, which is that there's a difference between a land that's guaranteed to be profitable and not guaranteed to be profitable. That the first one, even if you reduce money, that's still prohibited midrabanan. So he says that shekol mashkona benikoy bein bezdir amercha shaviros v'metzuyim v'chol shekin sadeh v'cherem akol benikoy mutter. That any mortgage where you deduct from the loan is allowed. V'cheinuagu b'artzeinu al piyem. And that was the minag in Spain. Anytime there was a mortgage, then they deducted some money, they considered that to be allowed, even if they were guaranteed profits. Nevertheless, he considers it advisable to be machmir, since many of the earlier authorities were stringent, again, absolutely stringent when it came to a place that was guaranteed profits, and stringent that you need nikoi by, they nikoi anyway in Spain, in a place that was not guaranteed profits. Okay, so you see that rabbis have always been recommending that was just always blindly following minhagim, although minhagim are very important and the accepted practice is very important and very informative of our halachic decision making, but it doesn't mean that it's always the absolute be all and end all. And even in 14th century Spain, the rabbis were telling people that it's better to be machmir when there's a serious issue over ribis potentially over here, and you got a lot of heavy hitters on the side, that it would in fact not be allowed. Ve'ezhu ribis ha'acheres she'amarnu le'malosh asur zichrona le'bracha b'nei ha'aramas ribis. There's an even lower category of ribis, which is not avak ribis even, but it's called a sneaky ribis. Kigon she'amar adam l'chaveiro halveini mane. You go to someone and say, please lend me $100. Ve'amar lo mane ainli, chitim emane yeshli. I don't have $100 in cash on me, but I do have wheat that is worth $100. V'nasan lo chitim b'mone, v'chazar v'lekachan mimenu b'tishim. So then he gave him the wheat, $100 worth of wheat, and then he found money somewhere, and he repurchased them for 90. So he made money off the fact that he gave him $100 worth of wheat, and then purchased them back for only $90. So that's not really ribis, because it's not a loan. They managed to, you know, construct this in a way that it's a business transaction and not a loan. It's a sale. Nevertheless, zebevadei min hadin mutar, according to the strict halacha, this should be allowed. Elosh asaru chachamim mipnei haramas ribis, because it looks, you know, not so good. It looks as if you gave 90 and you got back 100.
So then,
aval im avar va'asik kain motze mimenu kol hamea shafil avak ribis ein kan elamishum geder hu shechmiru chachamim badavar. So here, there's no obligation to return the amount that you made, because there's technically no ribis here at all, not ribis deraisa, not ribis derabanan. It only looks a little sneakily like ribis. So therefore, there's no problem of keeping the money at all. V'chemi shaisa sade mimushkenes biyado lo yachzor v'yasker osa leval hasada. That if you have a mortgaged field in your possession, you shouldn't now go rent it back to the original owner, because then it looks like he's paying you extra. Ibnei haramas ribis, even though this is all a rental transaction, that is not a loan transaction at all. Nevertheless, because of this issue of haramas ribis, v'chayotze binyanim elu, kemo shebaba gemara. Fine. V'avapi, shedvarim elu, asur mishum haramas ribis, yesh dvarim achirim, shen kein ribis mamesh, v'tiro osan chachavim. There's something that even look even more like ribis, nevertheless, are completely mutter. They didn't think that was there was any reason to make a rabbinical decree about these things at all. That if somebody owes you $100, and you have a document that says, hey, you know, Joe owes me $100, and he's not about to pay you back right away, so you need the money right now, so you sell the debt to someone else. And you say, here, if you give me $90 cash right now, I'm going to give you this document stating that Joe owes you now. He used to owe me, now owes you $100. So that looks a little bit like ribis. But nevertheless, it is permissible because it's not from the same two people. V'tiru gamkein she'iten adam l'chaveru dinar. And they allowed you also to give someone a coin, shiyomar li Yisrael acher shalvehu mana, as like a speaker's fee. If these examples he's giving are when you're dealing with different people, when you're dealing with a group of three as opposed to two. Ribis only applies when there are two people involved. If you have more people in the transaction, that, I mean, obviously not a group, you know, two people are borrowing for two people. I'm talking about there needs to be a two-way transaction. When there's, you know, a triangle going on, so then there's no ribis. So if you want to borrow money from someone and you pay someone else in order to convince that person to lend you the money, that also seems like you're paying out more money than you're getting back and you're in this loan. But nevertheless, that would be permissible. But derech klal, amar zichrona livracha, shelo asra Torah ela ribis haba miyad love lamalve. That according to the Torah, the rib is only prohibited when it comes from the hand of the borrower to the hand of the lender. V'inyanu l'fisha Torah tivchar berov le'olam v'taniach ha'pratim. That it could be that, you know, the some of these other cases that we mentioned sort of fall under the idea of ribis, the spirit of the law. But the Torah doesn't concern itself with every single individual case, that it goes by, gives general rules. That in general, interest happens when you have a borrower and a lender. But in these other fancy cases that don't involve one borrower and one lender, so the Torah doesn't discuss those. Even though that's true, that a lot of times in the Torah we find that there's a across-the-board rule, and you don't, even though there seems to be some things that should be included or not included in it, nevertheless, the rule applies the way it applies. Nevertheless, it's considered to be a midas chasidus to avoid any semblance of anything like ribis. V'chol ha-mechazer mevakesh tzadim lital ribis mi-Yisrael, sofo misroshesh. That if you look for heterim, you look for leniencies to charge interest to Jews, then you are going to end up in poverty. That if you deal in ribis, then your business is going to collapse. There is a cute story that Rabbi Reisman brings in his book, that there is a moneylender in a town in Europe who amassed a fortune. He was otherwise, I guess, basically observant Jew, but he amassed a fortune charging ribis to Jews. Couldn't help himself. I mean, I can't say that everyone can help themselves. He was very tempted by the prospect of such an easy way to make money. He had some capital. He became a moneylender, and he made a fortune charging ribis to Jews. So he died. So as a punishment, the Chevra Kedisha demanded from the heirs an extremely exorbitant payment for this man's grave. So the heirs were completely incensed about this, and they said, you know, what is this? A complete, this is totally exorbitant. So you're asking for $200,000 for a grave. Normally the grave costs $10,000. Why are you talking about $200,000 for the grave? So they went to Din Torah in front of Rabbi Akiva Eiger. So Rabbi Akiva Eiger listened to both sides, and he heard the complaints of the heirs of the moneylender, who said that it was totally exorbitant, and he said, but you know, I really think that's a fair price. So the heirs of the moneylender said, Rabbi, what are you talking about? How on earth is it a fair price for a grave? So he said, well, most of the time when the Chevra Kedisha sells a grave, the assumption is that it's going to be a temporary sale, that, you know, the person who's going to be buried in the grave is going to be buried there for a while until the resurrection of the dead, and then, you know, he won't have the use of the grave anymore. But if somebody lent beribis, so he's not going to be resuscitated from the dead. He's not going to be in Triaz HaMesim. So his use of the grave is permanent. So he should pay more money for the grave. Okay? Yeah, interest is really bad. That's why, and especially when you're the lender. That's why the Chofetz Chaim says that his father would never use a heter iska to lend money. He would only use a heter iska to borrow money when he needed it, and he couldn't find anyone to give him a free loan. Gam amru shepruta shel ribis goremes lo adam la'abed kama otzer shel mamon. That even if you're very wealthy, then if you get one penny earned of interest, that might cause the destruction of much of your property. V'yesa rube prate ha-mitzvah b'vav metziah perek ezu neshach. The fifth perek of Vav Metziah is the one that discusses the laws of ribis and is considered a very difficult limud. V'noegez b'chol mokum v'chol zman, it applies in all places in all times. V'zichar munikevos applies obviously to both males and females. If you violated this and you charged a biblically prohibited type of interest, then you violated a negative commandment. So if we forcibly extract the ribis from you, so just like if you steal from someone, they forcibly extract the money from you and give it to the person. That's what some say. Oh, Motzi and Oso Menuk Derech Kviya, I mentioned this before, that some say the Beis Din doesn't physically remove the money from him, but rather they beat him until he voluntarily gives back the money. Kederach shekofin lisrosh lo ratz lekayim mitzvos asay kigdas ketzas merabosenu yishmereim kale. So some of the rabbis say that you just do that and you don't actually physically extract the money. Vim hilva beribis aser medivreim shehu anikra avak ribis avar alav derabanan. That if you do rabbinically prohibited ribis, then you violated a rabbinical commandment. Bein ribis o yotze badayanin. So avak ribis is not taken out by the judges. But we have this general principle in Choshen Mishpat that even in cases where the Beis Din is not authorized to extract the money physically, nevertheless, if you're entitled to the money and it's really not proper that you don't have the money, if you go seize it yourself, then that's okay. And the Beis Din doesn't forcibly give it back to the other person. So, you know, so if you were charged avak ribis derabanan, and you went into the, you paid $100 in avak ribis, and you say, hey, that was avak ribis, you shouldn't have taken that from me. And you end up, you paid $100 in avak ribis, so you can sneak into the person's house, go under their mattress or wherever they keep the money, and count out $100 for yourself and pocket it and take it. And then the guy says, hey, you took $100 from me, and you weren't supposed to take it because the Beis Din doesn't force me to give back avak ribis. So then now they go to court, and the Beis Din says, sorry, you know, he took it, he had the right to the money, so even though we couldn't have forced you to give back the avak ribis, so nevertheless, he gets to keep it. Bim avar v'hilva b'ribis sh'asru zichron l'bracha v'nei haramas ribis levad ain't tzorech lomar shein motzien oso min ha'malve im l'kacho sh'afilu min ha'lov v'motzien oso v'nosin oso l'malve v'kevan sh'avru v'hisnu b'neim b'chach. So, but haramas ribis, when it's just sneaky ribis, which we said doesn't technically fall under the official category of ribis derabanan, so not only do we not force the lender to pay it back to the borrower if he collected it, but not only that, we force the lender to pay it. Because since it's not an official category of ribis derabanan, since they made this agreement between them, even though it was prohibited, then on a low level, but it was prohibited, we forced them to pay it anyway. Since they established a special category, if they had said, we don't like this either, and we're establishing it officially as a avak ribis, then you could have forced the lender not to pay. But they said, no, we want to leave it as a special low category called haramas ribis, so we don't want to impose these things. If it was done already, then we, and not only do we not take it back, but we enforce the transaction. Once the transaction was sealed and decided between the lender and the borrower, at that point we force it to take place, but certainly not beforehand. The Minchas Chinuch brings the fact, which the Sefer Chinuch did not discuss, was that you do not receive the penalty of Malkus for doing ribis because it's possible to pay it back. So just like any other thing that it's possible to affect restitution, so you don't receive the penalty of Malkus. Another thing the Minchas Chinuch brings is that it applies to no Gentiles, that even if the person is a Ger Toshav, so a Ger Toshav officially accepts the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nei Noach, lives in Eretz Yisrael, you know, is the top quality goy, as far as we're concerned. So you still would be allowed to charge this person ribis. And there are also times that it's also interesting that most times when a Jew is not observant, so at least lechumra they retain the status of being Jewish. So it goes without saying, you know, in terms of personal status issues, that a woman's child will still be Jewish, they'll still be able, if they give a ring and say, Aren Mikudeshli, they'll still be able to contract marriage and divorce. Doesn't affect, being non-observant doesn't affect their status. That effect, they lose their status as being Jewish for ritual purposes, usually only. That, you know, they can't blow shofar for you, they can't account for a minyan. Again, it depends exactly how bad, exactly what they have to do, exactly what category they'd fall in for each of these purposes. But for ribis, you'd be allowed to charge them ribis. If somebody's a really, really rebellious, non-observant Jew, then you'd be allowed to charge them ribis, which you would not think, because usually it's only on the chumra. But it says in the Torah, ula achicha lo sashich, you should not charge interest to your brother. The same, so non-observant Jews, to a large extent, are not fully considered to be our brothers. Achicha b'mitzvos. They're not really part of the free loan society that we're required to do over here. That, you know, there's, again, there's no ethical problem with charging interest. It's only if you're you join the club, so to say, of the free loan. So if you agree to abide by the rules of interest and all the other rules of the Torah, then you get the free loans. But if you don't abide by these rules, you don't get the free loans.
It's ignorant.
Right. But so Tinok Shenishba, yeah, it's very sticky exactly how you apply the category and exactly in what areas of halacha the person would still be considered to be fully Jewish and when not. It is very sticky. But here, you need actively ulachicha lo sashich. In order not to charge interest, they have to be called achicha. So if somebody is really systematically not observant, they're not called achicha, they're not called your brother. As opposed to other areas where, you know, since they're still Jewish, so then you're required to treat them as such. Yeah. I think maybe get started on this. Mitzvah Shin Mem Dalad. They call it Shin Mem Dalad. They call it Shin Dalad Mem. A lot of editions of Jewish books, when they have gematrias, and you get when the gematria spells something no good, so they switch it around. So, like, when you get the Simon, you get the Simon Reish Tzadi Ches, you know, murder, 298, whatever. So then they switch it to Rachatz, to wash, Reish Ches Tzadi. So here too, yeah. A lot of times they switch it to Mitzvah Shin Dalad Mem, but here, okay, they didn't do that. Shalol Na'avod Be'evet Ivri Avodos Bizayon Kemo Avodas Kanani. So we have to treat a Jewish slave better than a non-Jewish slave. In other words, not to work him as hard. Or in a manner that's as disgraceful. Shalom navod be'avod ivri be'avod sheish ba'bizayon gadol v'achno shederech lavod kein be'avod kanani. We shouldn't have him do labor for us that's really oppressive. Shenemar lo savod bo avod asavod. You shall not make him work in the manner of slaves. So amr zechran l'bracha b'sifra b'ferosh in zeh shal yitol acharecha be'linta v'hu kli shel beged katan shosim b'nei adam leishiv alav v'chol makom. So what you could ask your slave to do in normal situations, which is that he have like a stool to sit on, a portable little stool. So the owner, you know, is walking around and is, you know, to his plantation, so going around surveying his stuff. So he has his slave running after him with his little stool that he could sit on. So that would not be allowed. And actually, some interpret it as actually referring to a towel, not to a stool. That he runs after you with a towel. That if you have someone, you know, run along, and you have someone, you know, coming along with a towel behind you, then that would not be an appropriate manner of worship. I'm portion of working for an Eved Ivri. It would be for an Eved Kanani. He should not take your clothes to the bathhouse. It's not specifically these things, it's anything that's considered to be a really degrading form of labor. That you have to be really careful that you can't just work him any way you want. So that's why the Gemara says that if you acquire a Jewish slave, it's as if you acquired a master. Because there's not so much work there's work he can do for you, but you have to treat him with the utmost respect. So it doesn't really it doesn't really pay to if you're interested in him for heavy duty labor. Mikol makom mimash amar akasuv kisachir kisoshav yeimach. So it says that you should treat him as a hired worker or a sharecropper. So any of these things that you would, any work that you'd ask a free person to do for pay, and they'd be happy to do it, so that you're allowed to command your Eved Ivri to do. Uve'emes hasachir. I don't know, for pay, you wouldn't walk the, you wouldn't take someone's clothes to the bathhouse? I don't know. You know, in the olden days, people had, you know, maids and valets, and they would have very rich people, and they, their job would be to run around making sure that they were well-dressed at all times. They were paid very well. Okay. Most of the time, he does not, he's not hired for a really degrading form of labor. It's a wandering labor, itinerant, what's it called? Laborer. They get room and board and they get to work for him. Since they're free people, they're not going to do a malacha that's completely degrading. And that's why the Torah says, so these people work hard, but it's not a really degrading form of labor, so okay, that's how you should, that's the general standard by which you should treat your Eved Ivri as well, even though he's a slave. That the slave is supposed to remember he's a slave. He's not going to say, so I'm supposed to say to his master, are you sure you want me to do that? You know, I'm an Eved Ivri. You know, it's as if you were kona adon la'atzmecha, as if you bought a master for yourself, so treat me as such. Nevertheless, he has to still be subservient. It's really just the master's mitzvah, not work him in a degrading manner. So we are the most exalted nation. So you have to love your fellow Jews and you have to love the Torah. That was really just because the Eved Ivri was sold to you, just because he was in an emergency situation. Either he couldn't afford anything, so he sold himself, or he was he stole and he couldn't pay back. So you have to realize that this could be you. Something could happen to you that could cause you to be sold into slavery as well and become an Eved Ivri. And that's why you have to treat your Eved Ivri with respect. And you're going to be careful not to sin to God. Then you should, you'll train yourself to deal with others with loving kindness and mercy, and you're going to distance yourself from cruelty. When you get in the habit that even though he's your slave and you can do whatever you want with him, you, that's the mindset you might have. If you overcome that and you treat him with relative respect, then it's going to be good for your general character traits. And if you treat, make your soul do good, so you'll receive good from God. God wants to bless his creations. So it said many times that the point of the mitzvahs is to give an opportunity for God to bestow his blessings upon his creations. Dine ha-mitzvah, the lachos of the mitzvah are as follows. Because it is good for you, him with you. Don't give him whole wheat bread if you're eating white bread. Okay, nowadays a lot of people prefer whole wheat bread because of the health benefits, okay? When you're having him over for a Shabbos meal, because you have to feed him, so you open two bottles. So one is a 2000 vintage Bordeaux, and one is a bottle of Kedem grape juice. So you take, you uncork the bottle, pour yourself a glass. You know, this is what a great vintage. Ah, grape juice. This is for you. This is for me, you know. This is my side of the table. You have the grape juice, I have the wine. That is not allowed. If you're drinking wine, you have to give him the good wine. Ata yoshin agabe muchen. Vu yoshin agabe hateven. That you get a mattress and he sleeps on the floor. Literally means you sleep on, you know, cushions of fibers, and he sleeps on straw, different kinds of mattresses. You have to give him a good mattress. If you have a good mattress, you have to give him a good mattress. That you shouldn't live in the city and he in a small town. It applies to males and females at a time when the Yovel Noeg, because that's when there's Eved Ivri, when there's the Yovel. I already told you what time the Yovel was doing. That we point out before when we're learning the mitzvah of Eved Ivri, that a woman is, she can, it's physically possible, you know, monetarily, for a woman to purchase an Eved Ivri, but this is considered to be very inadvisable, because a woman is purchasing a man that is subject to her every beck and call and whim, so she might decide that she requires certain services from him one day, and you might lend appearances to that. So therefore, a woman is not supposed to buy an Eved Ivri. But should she, violate this and purchase an Eved Ivri, she would be still subject to this mitzvah that she would have to treat him well. And if you violated this and you worked your Jewish slave with a denigrating type of labor, it doesn't have an action associated with it, therefore you wouldn't receive the penalty of Malkos. Because just by speaking, so generally, with some exceptions, speaking in the Torah is not considered a mice, and not an action, you wouldn't receive Malkos. That even if you physically, force him to do something for you, nevertheless, it would still be considered lav shein b'maisa, because in general, this prohibition is violated with words rather with action. So it gives the whole mitzvah the name of a lav shein b'maisa. Ze darki zachbein. I like this understanding of the mitzvah, even though others might disagree with this analysis.